supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. We're going to talk to the author of a new book about rooftop gardening, and we're going to reveal that it might actually be possible to grow your own papayas even in a non-tropical climate. But, of course, we also want to squeeze in lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. Does anybody call you Michael? Only women call me Michael.
Only when I'm in trouble.
Because I grew up the same way, man. Michael?
Sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah. And where are you, Mike?
Spokane, Washington.
Oh, always nice to hear from our listeners there. And I promise I'll never confuse it with Seattle again. I know you have a different climate. Okay, what can we do for Mike in Spokane?
My family and I, we just moved into a new home. The previous owners had what appears to be a garden in the back, but we have some concerns as to how to kind of start our garden there as well. It's been vacant for about a year. And from what we can tell, they used it most recently for a dump heap for grass clippings and yard waste, obviously, but it seems like maybe some other stuff as well. The house definitely had quite a few pets at one time, and so we're concerned that maybe they dumped cat litter and stuff back there. There's a section that I don't know if they were trying to solarize something, but they left out some clear plastic on about half of it, and then some, you know, just concrete, you know, remnants of some patio and just some stuff like that. But we'd want to do raised beds eventually and maybe do some fruit trees and some berries and things, but not sure if how to go about if we need to start from scratch and just, you know, raise the place, or if we should try composting it and then using that material.
Right. I got you. So how bad was the house?
It's pretty bad. There was we have one room we call the cat pee room, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you know, it's been vacant for a year. Where it's an old house, 100-year-old house, and it's lovely. It's got some great features, so we're excited to invest in it. We have a young family, two young boys, and so. One of the biggest draws was the yard. It has about twice the size of our last place, so we're excited to put in veggies and fruits and that sort of stuff.
But is the entire yard perhaps compromised, or do you have a nice area of lawn where you feel relatively safe to let the kids play?
Relatively safe. Basically, the backyard has only two or three trees. One is an apple tree that's been a long time since it's been adequately pruned, a cherry tree to match that's maybe 50 or 60 feet tall, and then another very old cherry tree that someone hacked off and now is only about 10 feet tall, but just looks horrid.
Right.
So in the front yard, they at some point just mowed everything, the beds and everything. So there's a little stubble of irises and things. So people didn't care a lot for it. It hasn't been watered in a year. So everything is just a tinderbox there. We were just going to, you know, call our losses for this year and just try to make some plans for next year, how to start in the spring.
Well, are you going to turn either of these areas into a lawn for the boys to play on?
Yes, in the back. So there's about half of it is going to be lawn, and then the other, it's a fenced off area that they had as a garden. So maybe 20 by 40. It's quite a big area that they have fenced off. You know, all of it we want to make sure is safe, but where we're growing veggies, we want to definitely make sure we don't have compromised soil issues.
Right. I would presume that they took as good care of the land as they did the house, and I would have everything hauled out to the dump.
You would. Okay.
Yeah. And wear protective gear. I don't want anybody handling or inhaling this soil until we get some tests. Once you can get down to the soil, I want you to at least test it for lead. Because you said it's an older house, the land is close to the house. That's often a source of lead contamination. Now, the part that you're going to turn into the garden, That's easier to deal with. Once that's all leveled out, I want you to lay down like a giant piece of cardboard over top of the entire area that you're going to turn into the raised bed garden, or multiple pieces. And then on top of the cardboard, put your raised bed frames that are no wider than 4 feet. It can be as long as you want. Leave 2 foot lanes in between, and then fill those raised beds with a mixture of nice screened black topsoil and compost. And then you're not worrying about what's in the native soil. For trees, however, and for small fruits like raspberries, that's where you want to have that soil tested more for contaminants than for pH and nutrients. And I know you want to get started. So the first thing I want you to do is have that area cleared, lay down that cardboard, build your raised beds. I mean, you guys have a long season out there. And then take your time with the fruit trees and even things like the raspberries and small fruits, because it's clear you have a lot to do inside. So I would love to see you hire somebody to clear that land for you, who has the equipment, who takes the correct protections. Then you do the work of sealing off the soil and obtaining the new soil and building the raised beds. If you can do that, I think that's more than enough for the first couple of years while you make sure all the house is livable and safe. And then when you're not burnt out, as you've paced yourself, then you move on into the fruit trees and the small fruits. But it sounds like those old trees should just go.
I think so, too. Okay. Well, great. I appreciate your advice, and we'll take it to heart.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Vicki, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Vicki. How are you?
Fine, and yourself?
I am doing very well today. Vicki, where is Vicki Fine?
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
What can we do for Vicki in Oklahoma City?
Well, I was calling because I have one of the little ornamental peach trees, and it's not real tall, but it produces peaches, and I wanted to know, are they edible?
Vicki, what makes you think that you have an ornamental peach tree?
Well, I guess that's what they call them, but they have the little, I guess, burgundy color leaves.
And how did you obtain this?
I grew it from a clipping that I took from someone's house. I worked for them, and they had all these little babies were springing up out of the ground. So I took a couple of the babies, and I grew them in a pot for a while, and then after they got to the point to where I could put them in the ground, I put them in the soil, and they've been in my front yard. I guess it's been about maybe 4 years now.
That would be perfect timing. Now, how big is the mother tree, Vicki?
I guess maybe 5 feet tall.
Okay.
And the little peaches that grow on it, they look just like peaches. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're red and they're pretty and, you know, and I just wondered.
The people who gave you these baby trees, did they call it an ornamental peach tree?
No. I just assumed that's what it was because a lot of people grow them in their yard and they're just there and they're pretty and and they don't get real tall.
Right. I think I have nothing but good news for you.
What is that?
I think you simply have a lovely peach tree, a true peach tree. And the only reason your peaches are small is there's a couple of things that you're not doing. But I think if you follow some basic instructions, you're going to be eating peaches this time next year. So here's what you do. And it blossoms beautifully in the spring, right?
Yes.
After it blossoms in the spring, I want you to do a little gentle pruning. If there's branches overlapping each other, or if there's one branch going up too high, I want you to take those branches off. This is good for the tree. This is actually going to get it to grow bigger and faster and stronger.
Okay.
I want you to take off like 20 to 30% of the branches. This is good for the tree. And when you do that, you should be opening it up, making sure the center is nice and open, that there's good airflow through it. And then when the little peaches start to form, this is the hardest work. I want you to remove 3/4 of them. When you remove most of the peaches, that gives this little tree enough strength to make the remaining peaches full size, or at least bigger. And then as the season progresses, you'll see eventually they start to develop that blush. That's when you want to start feeling them up. You just want to go out and apply gentle pressure to them, because the blush doesn't mean they're ripe. What you have to do is wait until it starts to yield a little bit, because an unripe peach is very hard. It's like an apple. But when it starts to get ripe, it'll start to get the least little bit soft, and that's when you can start taking the soft peaches off, bring them inside, allow them to finish ripening. You'll be able to tell by the smell, and then we'll see what your peaches taste like.
Okay. I thank you so much.
All right, Vicki. Thank you. That's a great call.
Thank you. You have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind homeowners with cool season lawns, that's fescue, rye, and or bluegrass, that now is the time to aerate compacted soils, sow fresh seed in bare spots, and deliver the biggest natural feeding of the year to your turf grass. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter L in the A to Z answer section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, growing on rooftops, and how to grow your own garden fresh papaya. Believe it or not, I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer and early fall are the time to plant garlic and spring bulbs and cool weather crops like salad greens and pansies. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, yes, it is entirely possible that you can grow your own papayas, just like garden fresh tomatoes. We'll tell you all about it. We'll also take more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our special guest, Lauren Mandel, the author of Eat Up, the Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Lauren holds a Master of Landscape Architecture from the University of Pennsylvania and a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Science. She is a project manager and rooftop agriculture specialist at Roof Meadow, where she designs green roofs and oversees rooftop agriculture projects throughout North America. Lauren, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, I have to say that an increasing amount of my emails are people asking about growing on rooftops. And I will tell you that the first, well, there's like eight first things I ask them because, you know, they bought a house or something and they don't have any room to grow outside, or people keep stealing the vegetables from their little yard and they want to use their roof. And the first thing I ask them is, can you get access to the roof? Have you thought about how you're going to get soil and water up to the roof? And do you think it's structurally sound? Those are the starting points, right, for just a human who wants to do this, to have their own garden up high.
Absolutely. Those are some of the very first things that you want to think about before climbing up to your own roof and getting started. And the load capacity issue in particular, so making sure that your roof is strong enough to support the weight of the soil, the plants, and the water that's going to be up there, is very important. And it's best to speak with a professional about that.
So in your work, you always have a structural engineer on a rope nearby, right?
That's correct. Always on every project before we get started.
One thing people misunderstand, I mean, even outdoors on a patio, if you're paying attention, a medium-sized container after a couple days of heavy rain is darned heavy. So it's not just the stuff you're hauling up to the roof. It's that stuff when it's totally saturated with water, when it can weigh, what, 3, 4, 5 more times?
Right, exactly. It can get very heavy, and you don't want to mess around, especially when it's your own roof.
Yeah, right. A big container right in the center of an ill-planned
right.
roof.
And the structural engineer will help you not only guide you to how much weight you can put on the roof, but he or she can also tell you where exactly that weight can go.
In Philadelphia, first of all, flat roof is highly desirable. And you see in Center City, a lot of people build decks on their roof. Now, once that deck is built, I think you almost have a free pass on growing a fair amount of stuff on the deck itself, because the deck has already been hopefully constructed to distribute weight.
Exactly. It does distribute the weight. And oftentimes when people are interested in building a deck on top of the roof, they will speak with an architect who will speak with a structural engineer. So if the architect knows in advance what you're planning to do, then your options are very flexible.
And obviously, if somebody has a rooftop deck, they got a way to get up to it.
Right, exactly. And it's important to look into the building codes that are specific to your city. And so different cities will actually tell you the ways in which they want you to get up to the roof safely.
You've visited a lot of homeowners' gardens. You visited a lot of industrial-sized gardens
roofs.
What's the craziest way you've ever seen that some jamoke decided they were going to get out onto their roof?
Well, you know, there's a lot of crawling out windows that occurs. Sometimes it's safer than others. There are some people who try to get up with a ladder, which is a little bit silly. The best thing to do is to find out what's legal, especially if you're going to be going up regularly. And oftentimes what that requires is a staircase that goes all the way up to the roof through something called a head house.
What's a head house?
A head house, which is also called a pilot house, is basically a staircase that extends all the way up to the roof. And there's a door at the top and a small vestibule that provides access to the roof from the downstairs. In some of the larger buildings, they'll even have an elevator, a freight elevator, for example, that goes all the way up to the roof. And that's really useful when you're moving large quantities of soil and compost and vegetables around. And in the world of rooftop farming, we use a lot of cranes. So we're using big equipment in the beginning during construction to get large amounts of fabrics and soil and other materials up to the roof.
Because there are farms on top of roofs. Now, these are all industrial buildings.
Most of them are these industrial buildings, specifically in Brooklyn. That's where most of them are.
And there's a place in Wisconsin where the guy has goats on the roof?
Yeah, it's called Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant and Boutique. He's got a whole herd of goats right on his roof. Draws in quite a crowd from all over the country.
Now, let's go back to the average homeowner, because this is a dream that everybody with a flat roof has. And I will tell you that back in the 90s, I actually designed a rooftop garden for Rodale. Rodale's New York headquarters was across the street from a homeless shelter that had been built in like this Ghostbusters building that was all steel frame, that was just the most solid building you've ever seen. And there was a stairway right up to the roof. And I went up there with a structural engineer, and we decided to just line the entire outside of the roof, inside, so to speak, but the outside corners, all the entire area, with growing boxes about 3 feet up in the air. You know, made sure they had drainage, had like lanes underneath to carry the drainage water down the same way of rainwater on the roof. And boy, did they kick growing herbs and cucumbers and salad greens and everything up there.
Yeah, and that's a really smart approach because oftentimes the strongest part of a roof is the perimeter. So putting your boxes there is a good place to start, so long as it's okay with the structural engineer. So one thing that I tell my clients is that you have to keep in mind how much weight you're adding over time. So you have to think about your compost strategy. You have to think about what your farm's going to weigh a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, to make sure that you're not exceeding the load capacity.
What? Yeah, but the load capacity, to me, the tricky part would be, I guess you go by cubic yards of soil, and then there must be very specialized structural engineers who can figure out how that material is going to change in weight when it's dry and when it's wet.
Right. So in the green roof world, a lot of our information comes from geologists. And so we use not just regular growing soil, but we use specially formulated green roof media in order to plant plants on a roof. And the properties of the green roof media are that it has a higher mineral content, lower organic content, and it doesn't compact and degrade as quickly over time. Now, the trick of this is when you're growing vegetables and you want as much organic content as you can, how do you deal with that? How do you handle it? And people right now are experimenting with different strategies, trying to figure out what works best.
Right. We should explain to people that although sometimes they cross over, a green roof is very different than rooftop agriculture. A green roof, from what I picked up in your book, the guy in Wisconsin, the goats on his roof, he built his own home version, so to speak, from the old country of a sod roof, you know, just to get the benefits of the insulation and everything, and, you know, built kind of a non-traditional green roof, because traditionally a green roof, as we use them today to insulate buildings and put oxygen into the city air, the plants don't really grow that much. It's almost all sedum, right? Really?
That's right. Most of the green roofs in our area are sedum green roofs, which are designed specifically for stormwater management. So that's another huge benefit that we see from both green roofs and also rooftop farms and gardens. But we should also point out that there are other types of green roofs out there as well, ones that have trees and shrubs and all different kinds of perennials and grasses.
But the original green roof,
yes,
was just something you could see maybe from the street, maybe you could see from like a maintenance stairwell, but people had this idea it was this garden you could go up and walk through, and that was not the case with most green roofs. They were there to be functional, not to be like little bits of parkland 17 stories in the sky.
Right. Using rooftops as amenity spaces is somewhat of a new thing in this country. It's been going on in other places in the world for a long time. But here in the U.S. and in Canada, we traditionally have seen green roofs as just stormwater management entities.
I'm really thinking that a roof that is decked out is just so much easier to do this on than a roof that has nothing done. And maybe the first step in actually making a rooftop the family garden would be to deck it out first.
Yeah, and one of the other benefits that we didn't mention about a deck is the fact that you can add a railing around the perimeter of the deck. And this is very useful if you want to comply with local building codes.
And in terms of not falling to your doom.
And also, you want to keep the kids on the roof. You really don't want them falling over the side, walking onto your neighbor's roof, anything like that. So having a railing that's to regulation height is really critical. And you can even use your railing for climbers.
So first of all, you want to make sure it's structurally sound, easy to walk on, easy to access. Then you've got to figure out not only the weight, because hopefully in the construction process, the weight has all been accounted for, but you got to haul this stuff up there. Let's just talk about having a lot of containers or boxes. I love the idea as I get older of tabletop gardening, you know, of big boxy containers sitting up on like picnic tables or supported by heavy stands so that you're not bending over. Especially for things like salad greens and herbs, it makes so much more sense. But you have to haul up all the material.
That's a great solution. And something that we also want to think about is irrigation. So how are you watering these plants up there? How are you getting water up to the roof?
If you got a big roof, And if you're putting a big deck on it and you want to have big plants, would you actually suggest hiring a plumber to run a pipe up through your roof?
Oh, I would. And that's actually relatively inexpensive relative to some other improvements that you might need. So any kind of structural reinforcement will cost a lot of money. Sometimes building the deck itself can be quite expensive, but just adding a place for water access on the roof is pretty inexpensive.
Lauren Mandel is the author of Eat Up, the Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Before you start dragging the planters up through your windows and trying to get out onto your roof, read Lauren's book, Know What You're Doing. It is a great amount of unused space. There is so much rooftop space in our urban areas where people could be growing their own food and food for others. But you need to know what you're doing. Lauren, you've written a great book to help people understand those needs.
Thank you so much.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Barry, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm doing good, but my lawn's not doing too great.
And where is Barry's lawn?
Well, right outside of Lansdale. In Montgomery County in Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. A suburb of Philadelphia.
Yep.
So tell me, what's wrong with your lawn?
Well, we moved into the house about 2 months ago, and the lawn appeared to be fine. I didn't know what the previous owner treated it with, but it's 3/4 acre. And it seemed, you know, right after we had all that real hot weather, maybe 8 days of 90-degree weather, it was humid. And before that, we had like 4 or 5 days of 90-degree weather. And all of these dead patches are appearing all over my lawn. You know, I looked it up on the internet, and it looked like it was grub damage.
No. Japanese beetles females have only been feeding recently. So they are just beginning now to lay their eggs in the soil. So if you had grub damage, that would show up at the very end of summer into the early fall when the baby grubs had gotten big enough to really chew down on parts of your roots.
Okay.
I'm going to suggest you instead have a fungal disease called brown patch. You don't know what kind of a lawn you have. You inherited it, right?
I don't know.
Right.
All I know is it's, besides the dead areas, there's huge patches of the nuts edge. The yellow nuts edge, that's all over the place, too. And I just ordered something Nasogram, or if I forget what the name of the stuff is called, for the nuts edge.
If you use that, it's going to imperil you, man. Think about what you're doing, spraying some very noxious poisons for a lawn. Does that really make sense? I mean, you're not, this isn't something you need to survive. This isn't like your food. But, for instance, if you're on a well or you want to walk on that lawn or you have dogs or children playing on the lawn, you're turning it into a plutonium factory. And it's not going to stop. Yes, and it's not going to stop the nutsedge.
Okay.
Nutsedge is one of the hardest, quote, weeds to control. But it also sounds like your lawn has a mess of problems.
It looks horrible right now.
I guess when you bought it, it was at a time when the lawn is going to look its best. Your lawn is a cool season lawn, I can tell right away. They are stressed by the heat of summer. Normally, when we go through a heat wave, if a lawn has been cared for well and at least semi-organically, it may get a little brown with drought, but it'll green up as soon as the heat wave is over. When a lawn develops brown patches during times of high humidity and times of high heat, that's the sign of an overfed lawn, and especially a lawn that has been fed with cheap, quick-release, heavy-duty industrial chemicals.
Okay.
These are the high numbers on the bags, and it's all quick-release nitrogen. It's the stuff that's really destroying the Chesapeake Bay and other water supplies. The secret to having a great-looking lawn is very simple. It should never be cut lower than 3 inches. When it's watered, it should be watered deeply and infrequently. And you feed it once in the fall and once in the spring. If you're going to insist on using chemicals, at least get gentle, slow-release lawn food. Not the really cheap, quick-release stuff. Obviously, I would prefer you to go organic, but it looks like you pull a gun on everything that moves near you, so we're going to have to, like, wean you away from this. Now you have two options. I mean, if you have nut grass and the lawn just basically doesn't look good, you do have the option of tearing it up and starting over again. You would do that at the end of August through the beginning of September. You can't do it in the spring in your region. Otherwise, you'd be cutting it 3 inches, feed it once in the fall, very gently, slow release, and then again in the spring. You can use corn gluten meal in the spring, especially around the house. That'll prevent new weed seeds from sprouting. And then if you care for the lawn correctly, believe it or not, 3 inches, never lower, leave the clippings on the lawn, feed it twice a year, your grass will outcompete the nut sedge. And the brown patch will go away because it won't have the chemicals to feed it.
Well, that sounds like a really easy solution.
Those are the ones that work, and they don't endanger your family.
Good.
Okay, Barry?
Okay, well, that sounds great. Thanks, Mike.
All right, good luck, sir.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be the guest speaker at the second annual Frenchtown Green Fair at 1 o'clock on Saturday, September 28th in Frenchtown, New Jersey. And I'll give a free talk on turning your fall leaves into garden gold for the Lower Merion Conservancy at St. Joe's University on Wednesday evening, October 23rd. But don't go looking for all the compost-rich details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and how to grow your own backyard papaya plants. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden host Mike McGrath will lead a small group of adventurous plant lovers on a culturally rich tour of the gardens of Cuba this coming January. Details at earthboundexpeditions.com. Earthbound Expeditions supports You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that summer is the time to obtain garlic and spring bulbs for planting in the fall, as well as seeds for fall crops of pansies, salad green seeds, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will reveal the fact that, yes, you maybe actually can grow your own papayas, your own tropical fruit. If you're willing to provide the right conditions, it may almost qualify as easy. You won't want to miss the details. And you won't. They're coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Matt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you, Mike?
I'm doing good, Matt. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
And where is Matt Great?
In Brooklyn, New York.
What can we do for Matt in Brooklyn?
I'm looking to get a little more information about the lifespan of growing basil in potted soil. We have a little Juliet balcony off in our apartment, and we planted some basil there, which was growing like a rock star for a while. And we used Home Depot soil and just real simple off-the-shelf stuff. But then after, I think, two cuttings, it started to really go south. It was like getting yellow. I don't know if it's the time of year, but I was just curious to see if you have any input. I know a lot of people grow simple herbs like that, myself and other people I know also. So I think it'd be good for everyone to hear how to make this thing last for a while to get more as much pesto as possible out of this.
Absolutely. You're completely correct, Matt. Basil is one of the most popular herbs. There is a huge diversity, and there are a couple of tricks to growing it over the long course of a season, which is you never have too much basil, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So what kind of a container? Let's start with that. Or is it plastic, ceramic? It's got drainage holes?
It's plastic, yeah.
And it has good drainage holes in the bottom?
Yes, definitely.
But let's be honest, you filled it with less than perfect potting soil.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. And how big is this container?
It's probably about 8 inches by 24 inches by 8, probably 6 maybe. And it hangs on the actual rail.
Oh, so it's like a window box.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's very ideal for basil because that means your drainage is always going to be good. Next year, I want you to go to a little trouble, go to a nice independent garden center or nursery, and I want you to get a real premium bag of seed starting mix or really light potting soil. And what did you feed your basil?
Didn't feed it anything. We bought it from the store, and it had its own soil, and we added soil to it.
Right. Now, when you say you bought it from a store, are we talking you bought little plant starts, like where they were selling tomatoes and peppers, or you bought the basil in the supermarket in the plastic bag with the roots still attached?
It was in a little container, like a little plastic container, which
Good.
We took out of there and added to a larger container.
We're going to save you money. You're not going to buy plants next year. What I want you to do is get a good seed starting mix. You know, if you go out and get a good organic seed starting mix, it'll already have some natural fertilizers in it, things like worm castings, and, you know, it'll be nice and light and loose, and it'll feed your plants for a while. Then what I want you to do is decide what kind of basil you want. Now, you're talking pesto, so do you want that big Genovese, that Italian big leaf basil? Or do you want some of the tiny leafed little basil that has that really intense aroma and the really beautiful plant forms?
Probably the larger leaf.
Well, what you want to do with basil, even with Italian large leaf basil, which is longer lasting than most, what I want you to do is fill the container with a nice light loose potting soil, and then I want you to soak the container well. Then I want you to get a pack of the seeds of the basil that you want to grow. And I want you to sow those pretty thickly on the surface of the soil. And then just cover those seeds with like an eighth of an inch more potting soil. And then get just a little mister and mist the surface until it is nice and moist. You know, do this when the weather warms up. Your basil will be up in 5 or 6 days, and then thin it. When the plants are too close together, just take out entire plants, and don't be afraid to just eat them. They make a delicious little snack. Eating your thinnings is an underutilized part of gardening. And then as the plants get bigger, what you want to do is you want to learn how to pinch them, you know, where they form that leaf cluster with the little non-leaf thing in the center. You want to keep pinching that back, literally just with your thumb and finger. And that'll force more leaves to grow. It'll also delay any flowering. But as you harvest your basil, you can cut it back once, and it'll probably regrow for you. But the smarter thing to do would be devote your container into sections and sow a new run every month. That's always going to be the best tasting basil. And people who really love their pesto, they're sowing fresh runs of basil all summer long. In Brooklyn, in the heat of a city like you are, I think you should be growing at least 4 runs of basil over the course of a summer.
Okay.
You never want to be without your basil, man. Once you know this,
right.
You know, people will be thinking you're a genius.
All right, thanks so much, Mike.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thanks. right, thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am hanging on by a thread, Barb. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good.
And where is Barb really good?
Newcastle, Delaware.
Very good. What can we do for Barb in Newcastle?
Well, I've heard you speak about corn gluten meal. We applied it to a very poor lawn in the spring, timing it with the blooming of the forsythia. I think that I've heard you talk about it, applying it in the fall as well, but I don't know what the timing would be for that or, you know, how critical that is to apply it in the fall as well as the spring.
Well, it's interesting. This is something our good friend Nick Christians, who I keep promising I'm going to write a lawn care book with, he told me just last year about this fall application of corn gluten meal that prevents winter weeds from germinating. Things like dandelions, clover, henbit. You know, I said, Nick, why didn't you tell me this before? And he says, I've been trying to tell you this for 12 years. You're just too thick to listen sometimes. So I believe him. So in the spring, corn gluten meal applied, as you say, just as the forsythia herb coming in to bloom, will defeat all the crabgrass seeds that were dropped the previous year. Now, as we get into the fall, however, for cool season lawns, fall is like the time to do everything. If your lawn is heavily compacted, the soil is all compacted and dense, this is the time to rent a core aerator and pull plugs out of the lawn. It's also the time to overseed lawns that are mostly fescue that have some bare spots. Or if you're giving up the ghost or have a bare area, this is the time to sow the seed of a new lawn. It works much better now than you'd ever have a chance of it working in the spring. It's also the time when our cool season lawns need the biggest feeding of the year. So when the corn gluten came into the equation, the perfect timing for that was about a month ago, actually. Well, and this summer was weird because Nick says the timing is when the summer heat abates, and we just had a very cool and wet summer. So we didn't really have that heat stress that we would normally have. Normally, if you're troubled with things like dandelion, clover, and henbit, and you don't need to seed your lawn, you don't need to add any seed to it, the perfect time to add corn gluten would be around August 15th to September 15th. But you said your lawn didn't look good earlier in the spring, and you gave it a nice feeding, and you destroyed any weed seeds. What does your lawn look like now?
Well, we don't have as much crabgrass. It still doesn't look great. It's going to take a lot of work to get it back into shape.
Now, are there bare spots?
There aren't any bare spots, but
okay.
We have very little grass. We have quite a bit of clover, and we have, and I don't know what it is, it's a creeping weed. The leaves look like little tiny scalloped leaves.
Right, so you have creeping Charlie.
Okay, creeping Charlie.
So here's your choices. Most of all, you want to feed your lawn something now before it gets any later in the season.
Yeah.
And then in the spring, you want to make sure you do that corn gluten again, because it sounds like you did it perfectly. And then if you're still seeing the clover and stuff, then you want to have the corn gluten in hand. And next summer, as we get into August, the first time the heat breaks, then you want to put the corn gluten meal down on your lawn then, you know, which typically is towards the end of August. The Creeping Charlie, if you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z. I'll say go to C, but you could go to almost any letter of the alphabet because this weed has like a million other names. Creeping Charlie, ground ivy, lawn ivy. It goes by a million different names, but there's a really cool way to control it using 20 Mule Team Borax. But you have to get the proportions exactly right. So I always like to send people to the article so they can print it out and read it as they're mixing up the borax solution.
Huh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's a very strange kind of a weed. You should pull most of it up, and then it might be too late in the season to really herbicide it out with the borax, which is totally non-toxic. But it sounds like you can be ready next year. The most important thing, like I said now, don't go into the winter without feeding your lawn. This is the time to give your grass its biggest feeding, and it can be with the corn gluten meal. But then next year, corn gluten in the spring, corn gluten at the end of August, and in the hot time of the summer, you can really kill that creeping Charlie with the 20 Mule Team Borax.
Well, good. Thank you very much. I feel like you really answered every question that I had, and plus more. But thank you. Well, nice talking to you, Mike.
You too. Good luck, Barb.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Papaya, the surprisingly fast-growing tropical fruit. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you read us this week's very intriguing question?
Sure, Mike. We heard from Vincent near Hamilton, New Jersey, who writes, "Last spring I noticed some strange weeds in our garden. By fall, they were over 6 feet tall, and an internet search revealed that they were papaya plants, almost certainly from our compost, as we had enjoyed papayas that spring. I potted one up and put it in our small sunroom for the winter, where it grew all the way to the top of the curved glass ceiling. I am writing this in May as I get ready to put it back out in the garden. Do you think I'll be able to invite you over for some fresh papaya this summer?" Well, Mike, do you think he'll actually get fruit?
Well, not at first, I certainly didn't. The photos he included showed a giant tropical tree that looked healthy enough, but it was already hitting the roof in that sunroom. It was going to be hard enough to get it outside alive, much less back in after a summer's worth of growth. And since most trees take quite a few years to bear any kind of fruit, especially when they're grown from seed, I doubted that a Jersey fresh papayatini was in my future.
But I bet something changed your mind.
Yeah, the papaya entry in our fruit expert Lee Reich's newest book, Grow Fruit Naturally, gave me more than a little bit of hope. As I expected, that tree will continue to grow rapidly, and it's going to achieve a final height of 30 feet. Or at least it would in the tropics, or in a sunroom with really tall ceilings. But Lee also explains that papayas are often self-pollinating, so you only need one tree. And the kicker, they can typically bear fruit their second year, even when they're grown from seed. So I excitedly emailed Lee to ask, is it possible that this guy might get some actual papayas this summer?
Well, what did he say?
To quote Lee, "It is not at all impossible to get fruit from that tree. As I even said in Grow Fruit Naturally, it's something I dream about doing myself someday. Since fruiting can begin within a year of seeding, my hope is that breeders are going to develop a papaya that can be sown indoors in late winter, grown in a sunroom through early spring, transplanted into the garden when warm weather settles in, and harvested late in summer, just like your tomatoes."
That would be amazing. A harvest of tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, and papayas?
You know, it might be possible to do right now if you live in a really warm climate. But Lee quickly cautioned me that a papaya grown in New Jersey, or anywhere else that's not super warm, is likely going to take longer to bear fruit than one in the tropics, where we get these numbers from. And, of course, this summer has seen some extremely long stretches of cool weather in the Northeast, with much of August 5 to 10 degrees cooler than normal. Those lower-than-normal temps may hold off the papayas this season the same way they've delayed a lot of people's tomato harvest. Papaya plants want temperatures in the 90s, and we got a lot of days that were just in the 70s.
So the plan may be good, but this summer was too cool?
Exactly. But you know, our listener obviously has the right kind of winter enclosure to give this project a serious try, especially now that he knows he has a real chance of success. So if this tree doesn't pan out, I'd get some fresh seeds and follow Lee's dream suggestion. Plant one seed in each of several big pots in that sunroom right at the end of the summer. Make sure the soil drains exceptionally well and that the initial pot is big enough because papayas don't transplant well. Temperatures of 70 to 90 degrees are ideal, so keep that room nice and toasty, especially the floor, as papayas like warm soil as well as warm air. Keep it away from drafts. Give it plenty of water, but don't let any water sit in that saucer under the pot. And don't move it outside next summer until nighttime temps are at least in the 60s. Once outside, give it as much sun as possible. Protect it from winds. Pray for a warm summer, and he might well have some big papayas by August.
Mike, I suspect a lot of our listeners have decent-sized sunrooms, or like you, bright lights that they rig up to start tomatoes and peppers. But could they get the lights up high enough?
Actually, height might not be an issue for people starting from scratch. Lee's book notes that a number of dwarf varieties are available that can fruit when they're only 3 feet tall.
Now it sounds like almost anybody could try this.
Well, not up in Michigan, they couldn't. But if you can provide the light and heat over winter and you have a good, long, really warm summer, I'd say it was a definite possibility. In fact, just as we were about to go on the air, I got a new email from Vincent, and he said little fruits are starting to form on his papaya. Well, that sure was an intriguing possibility about growing your own highly exotic tropical fruits, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pummel my papaya if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please tell us your name and where you live. Please, please, please put the actual subject in the subject line. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll probably find answers to those questions you were going to email us. You'll find audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Charlie Kyer. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Up on our roof, our editor Al Banks, production assistant Jolie Higazi, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, nowhere near tropical, Mike McGrath. But I am going to lead a tour to Cuba this winter, so I might well be tanned, rested, and ready when I see you. Well, not next week. Maybe in late January or February or... Oh, come on, guys. Play up on the roof already. What can you do when your township sprays toxins to control weeds? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss your options when frogs and toads are looking at you to be their Batman. Plus your fabulous phone calls.